Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. A reminder that we are doing a special Christmas Day episode, which is also going out on Times Radio. Me and Mariella Foster picking over some of the weirder best bits of our Times Radio shows in what we are calling Matt and Mariella's Selection Box. Well, if you want us to say hello to you on the podcast or on the radio, then get in touch with me now. Email me a hello. Let me know what you're going to be doing on Christmas Day. Who are you with or not with? Maybe you don't know what to buy someone for Christmas, and hearing their name on the podcast will make them happy. All you need to do is email me matt.chorley@times.radio with all the details. We'll say hello to you. Lovely stuff. Right, coming up on today's episode, have you had a busy year? Probably not as busy as Alok Sharma, the COP26 president. He spent the whole of 2021 sort of touring the world to try and get countries to sign up to new climate change targets. I've caught up with him to see how his year's been. He describes how his nostrils have taken a battering as a result of all the COVID tests from travelling around the world, why he got upset at the end of the COP26 summit, and what his plans are for the next year as Auditor-in-Chief, holding countries' feet to the fire to make sure they deliver on their promises. Really, really fascinating interview with Alok Sharma coming up. It's not often you use that sentence. But first, as ever, it's our columnist panel. Normally it's Night at the Marriott, but no Marriott today. James Marriott is poorly. We've got a note from his mum and everything. So joining India Night today is John Stevens from the Daily Mail. Have you spent the morning drawing up a list? Who is you're making a list and you're checking it twice? Who are you going to visit this Christmas, and who isn't making the cut? India, are you cutting back?
I am cutting back. I'm on a. I've also got a really horrible cough, but I've just tested negative, which is good. I'm completely cutting back. My only priority is my children. My children must be here for Christmas, and everybody else is, you know, expendable. I'm being really brutal about it. So yes, I'm cancelling things. Things around me are being cancelled by other people, and I think, you know, everybody is just desperate to have their nearest and dearest around them on Christmas Day. And after that, we'll think about it. But at the moment, yes, full culling mode.
John, are you doing the same? Are you culling?
Well, I'm not culling, I'm being culled. Literally.
Yeah, that dinner round at India is out of the way.
Yeah, sorry.
I know. So, I mean, everything I was due to do basically in the last week has been cancelled. And I'm not being particularly careful because I had COVID a few weeks ago. So I think I'm probably all right. I'm not, you know, worried about getting it again so soon. But most of my friends have all cancelled things. You know, I had a text from some this morning just saying, oh, the party we're meant to have the weekend, I'm not going to have it. I just want to see my granddad. I don't want to spend Christmas isolating. Another friend yesterday messaged and said, oh, I know we're meant to see each other the weekend, but my dad's got a pacemaker operation in the new year. I'm just trying to be a bit more careful. And I just think that's basically what everyone's doing. No one's really waiting to listen to what the politicians say, because they just don't want to spend Christmas alone and isolated. And I think that's just quite sensible, really.
Is there, I was quite interested because we've been talking about this with some, you know, people who ran a bar and that sort of thing, that we are essentially going into a form of lockdown by stealth, but the economic impact of that could be huge, India, that it's essentially like last year, you know, don't go to pubs and restaurants and nightclubs and parties and theatres, whatever else, you know, and be very careful. You know, I think, well, I was listening back exactly this time last year, on this very day was when Boris Johnson was saying, if you are going to visit people at Christmas from 5 days before, start, you know, keeping yourself away, have yourself a merry little Christmas and all of that. But at least this time last year, there was lots of financial support for pubs and bars and so on, which just doesn't seem to be there this time. The economic impact of this could be huge.
Yes, I feel incredibly sorry for them. I've got friends who own cafes and restaurants, and it's just a complete disaster because everybody's cancelling, all the bookings are vanishing, and there's nothing in place to support or help them. So that needs to happen. I think Mr. Sunak should maybe not be in Santa Monica. Oh no, and now my phone's going.
That's Rishi saying, yeah, he's cancelling you. He's not inviting you to Christmas.
hang on, I'm going to get rid of this person.
You go answer that. I'll speak to John. John, is there a risk for Rishi Sunak here politically? He's actually been incredibly popular the last 18 months. People have forgotten how many times he wanted to end furlough and, you know, open things up. He actually was actually very popular for a lot of the support he put in place. Could he undo all of that in the next sort of 2 or 3 months, do you think, if he doesn't do the same?
Yeah, I think you are right about people haven't noticed how many times he's done his own personal U-turns. I mean, last year he announced his winter economic plan, which was a watered down version of furlough. And then before it even come into place, the whole deal got ditched and he just went back to kind of classic furlough as it was. But I don't think people really noticed that. But the whole idea of him being in California is slightly more eye-catching. People do remember these things. Remember Sajid Javid when you had the problem of people crossing the channel 2 years ago? I mean, then it was just dozens of people coming a day and it wasn't really a crisis compared to now. Then he went on safari to Africa and then there were all these calls for him to come back from his holiday earlier. So I think people do, you know, a politician abroad in a moment of crisis, it does get noticed. I mean, he says he's away on a work trip, you know, it's a 4-day work trip. It's packed with meetings, but he does own a holiday home in Santa Monica. I think he probably is working. I think that is the case. But I think people will question, where is he? And Labour are certainly trying to capitalise on it. They've got a UQ today, an urgent question in Parliament, where they're asking Rishi Sunak to come and talk about what support he's going to give to business. Well, obviously, Rishi Sunak's not going to be there because he's not going to hot-foot it across the Atlantic. But you're going to have Labour having a free hit there. I'm sure they'll be posting on social media all about how Rishi Sunak was absent, how he had to send a junior minister in his place.
And I suppose, actually, India, who was it on the phone, by the way? Anybody on exciting? Somebody else cancelling?
No, I don't know what they were saying. It was a friend, stupidly. And that now she's texting me going, oh, no, I'm so sorry, you're on the radio. She keeps texting me. So it keeps pinging. Anyway, California, I think the problem with California also is rather like safari. You know, the word is so evocative. You immediately think of miles of golden sands and blue skies. If he was in Gdansk or, I don't know, Tirana, you know, people might mind less. But the associations you make with California are so pleasant and so unlike the situation at home that I think it really doesn't help, even if he is in meetings all day.
And it's so him as well, isn't it? All that. Yeah, exactly. He mentioned working in California twice in his party conference speech, is what we've got in the music that we're playing. You know, and all that sort of, you know, even if you can't see it yet, the future is here nonsense. It all sort of fits with him. Is the hoodies, the sliders, there's something a bit West Coast sort of internet startup, and you know, there's a touch of the Mark Zuckerbergs about him.
Do you know what there is? It's quite Meganish, isn't it? There's a touch of the Megans about him, which hadn't occurred to me before. I wonder how that'll work out.
maybe he'll decide he wants to take a step back from his life in the government and move to California and start a podcast. John, this perception that it's now Boris Johnson versus the scientists, which you know, makes several of the front pages today, not least your own. Is that just the reality of where we are in the pandemic now, that Boris Johnson needs to think about things other than just the virus? That, you know, there's the economic factors, there's the social factors. You know, that actually, it's always been slightly politics versus science. There's always been that tension.
Yeah, and I mean, he's definitely got a difficult balancing act this week after that vote in Parliament. He has got on one side the scientists, on the other side he's got his Tory backbenchers. And even though he's obviously avoiding bringing in any new restrictions, I think that Tory MPs would be annoyed if he was too forceful with the advice he was going to give to the public. But I mean, you listen to what they said yesterday. The scientists did go a bit further. I mean, Chris Whitty said, don't mix with people you don't need to. Nikki Kanani, who's from the NHS England, she said, if you're going to a football stadium this weekend, make it to get a vaccine, not to go to a football match. But you go back and listen to the language Boris Johnson used, and he was also talking about being careful. He said, we're not cancelling events. But he said that he thought people's instincts would be to be quite cautious. And I mean, Chrissy Whitty was saying similar things to that, saying people will prioritise the things that matter to them. And so obviously the scientists were going much further. It's easier for them to go much further. But Boris Johnson, you know, the message wasn't totally different in different directions. It was just, I think they were able to go a bit firmer, while Boris Johnson is very careful at the moment that he doesn't create further rows with his backbenchers after this week.
Yeah, and I suppose that, yeah, he's walking a line between, well, can you walk a tightrope between three sides? Between the scientists. Is that a triangular type of... But between the... I don't know what I'm talking about.
I think you're on the ground if you've gone between three different posts, but...
Well, it's more, I suppose, that he's... In the circus, he's not on the tightrope. He's just sort of standing on a pole and he could fall off in any direction. He's got the scientists, he's got the public, but he's also got his own MPs that he needs to try and keep happy. I'll tell you what, let's leave Boris Johnson standing on the top of a pole in a circus. Let's talk about books, India. There's a story in the papers today that parents are being urged to move on from reading the same old classics to their children and expose them to more popular books. So ditch the Enid Blyton and the Beatrix Potter and, I don't know, what, read them Fifty Shades of Grey or something. What do you make of this?
It's a weird story because I don't know. The Oxford University Press, whose concept this is, say that parents tend to read to their children the books that they were themselves read as a child, hence Enid Blyton and Beatrix Potter. I must say, I don't know anybody who only reads Beatrix Potter. They might read Beatrix Potter once in a blue moon or Enid Blyton, but, you know, normally it's a mix of classics and contemporary stories that you read children. And I think I don't like the idea of binning the classics. I think, you know, the OUP's point is that those stories are too undiverse and aren't particularly relevant to the modern day. But actually, they're all very kind of moral stories. They tell children, you know, that it's good to be polite, to be courteous, to think about other people, to not be selfish, to share, da 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 da. And then, you know, you can supplement that with stories about all sorts of people doing all sorts of different things or having more unorthodox lives. I think there's lots of room for both. I think it would really be a shame to lose one.
Yeah, and I have to say, one of the books they've recommended is called The Pirate Mums, about a boy who has two pirates for mums but wishes his family could be more conventional until he has an adventure. That I'm sure it's very good. It does sound slightly, John, like that might have been dreamt up by a committee.
Yeah, it does sound a bit contrived. I mean, I also find it quite funny that this suggestion of diversifying the books you have that you give to your children has been come up with by a book publisher. It's like, well, I can work out the motivation there.
Yeah. We'd like to recommend these books.
We've got these new authors who aren't really selling well, but ditch the popular ones. Come on, buy these. But yeah, I can see what you mean there. It does sound slightly too forced that, you know, if issues do come up in books, it can be helpful to talk to children about different things that they've read about and it can start a conversation. But when you start trying to force that from the top, I think then it starts to get a bit desperate.
Also, yes, children would complain. I mean, you know, a good book is a good book and a good yarn is a good yarn, and it doesn't really matter when it was published, I don't think.
India Knight and John Stevens there. And of course, you can read India in the Sunday Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next is my chat with Alok Sharma.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast. Now it's time for this. Have you had a busy year? Bit of work, family, holidays, children to look after? Well, imagine if you were tasked with saving the planet. Well, that's exactly what happened to my big guest today. Alok Sharma was the business secretary until January the 8th, when he was officially named president of the COP26 Climate Change Summit to be held in Glasgow in November. So began a whistle-stop tour of an overheating planet with all the difficulties that travelling at a time of COVID can bring, before then chairing the two-week summit, which ended in an hour of frantic, at times emotional negotiations. Well, I caught up with Alok Sharma, and I started off by asking him what success looked like at the start of the year when he took the job.
Yeah, so I think we set out fairly quickly on at the start of this year what success looked like. We said that all we wanted to do was to limit global warming and to keep the Paris temperature goals within reach. And, back in 2015, the world came together and world leaders said they would do everything they could to keep temperatures well below 2 degrees, pursuing efforts to 1.5 above pre-industrial levels. So that's why we always talk about keeping 1.5 alive. So that was the overarching aim. And then we talked about what we wanted to do in terms of getting countries to commit to more financing to support developing countries, to take actions to cut their own emissions, and a whole range of other things that we wanted to get over the line, including, after 6 years, concluding on all the rules governing the Paris Agreement, because that was a historic agreement, but it was a framework. All the rules, many of the rules were left for future COPs. So that was very important to get done. And we did, right? I mean, I think what we got over the line was pretty historic in Glasgow, but now we need to make sure that all of those commitments are actually delivered on by countries over the next few years.
Yeah, we'll talk about what your next 12 months looks like. You did a lot of travelling this year, partly to sort of get people on board with the agenda, but also to see for yourself the impact that climate change was having. When you look back, where have you been in this role where you thought, oh, blimey, this actually is pretty serious? What's the bit that sort of really, really sticks in your mind that really hit home, the real life impact of climate change right now?
Yes, I mean, I went to actually quite a lot of climate vulnerable countries, and there are a number of them that sort of stick out. One is a visit to Barbuda, we got there on the island, and this was hit by a hurricane 4 years ago. And actually, I had our High Commissioner with us who came, and he'd been there but sort of in the aftermath of it 4 years ago. And he was saying that actually there hadn't been a great deal of reconstruction. And if you stood there in the middle of Barbuda, as I did, and you looked around, you would literally think a hurricane had come in a few weeks earlier. I mean, the place was still devastated. And, you know, what's incredibly sad is that lots of people have not been able to return to their homes. I mean, we've had forced migration because of this climate event. I did talk to some of the community who are still on the island. And, you know, they said to me they're pretty fearful about the future because they can see these climate events becoming more ferocious, more frequent, and that's why they wanted the world to take action. I mean, it's really quite sobering. I mean, I was in Nepal. I went to meet some of these communities in the Hindu Kush mountains. And these are folks who were displaced from their homes because of a combination of drought and flooding. So, you know, you talk to these people and you understand at a very human level what climate change is doing to millions and millions of lives around the world.
Is it a problem, or when you were sort of trying to bring together some form of agreement, that those countries on the front line tend to be poorer, smaller, less economically significant, and therefore get slightly brushed aside, that actually if what was happening in Barbuda or you know, some of those other places, if that was happening in some of the big, you know, the big G7 economic countries, we might be a bit more gripped by the urgency of it?
Yeah, so I mean, the one thing I was very clear about when we sort of took on this role, that of course the UK has to be neutral in terms of this role of acting as broker or shepherd in chief, as I describe myself. but on the other hand, you know, I was always very keen to champion the developing countries, those on the front line of climate change, because you know, these are people who are not responsible largely for the problems that they're facing. And actually, you know, you talk about the big economies. Actually, we're all facing this right now. I mean, just look at what's happened this year. You've seen, you know, terrible flooding in China. You've seen that in Central Europe. You're seeing wildfires raging in America, in Australia. I mean, even in our own country. I mean, talk to farmers. They will tell you the impact that climate change is having on the yields of their crops. So this is something that all of us are facing. And you know, if we look around the world now, Matt, we are in a pretty fractured international politics. And yet on this one issue of climate change, the UK, because we built trust over 2 years, we were able to get almost 200 countries to agree on the Glasgow Climate Pact. And I think that shows that actually countries recognize this is a universal challenge that we all face.
Doing all that traveling around the world, you must be one of the most swabbed and tested people on the planet. How was it trying to go to those places? Because obviously sometimes if you are in negotiations, you want to be able to sit across the table from the people you're dealing with. But how was it doing all of that in a COVID world?
Well, I can tell you that my nostrils took quite a battering over this this year. And actually, I don't think very many people know this, but my team put together a league table of, how can I put it like this, the most stringent testing regimes around the world. I think for diplomatic reasons, I'm not going to reveal.
That's the obvious question. Who's been the most aggressive with your nostrils?
Matt, I've got another year of the presidency to run. Maybe I will come back this time next year and tell you. But it's, I mean, on a sort of serious note, it's you know, quite a challenge traveling during these COVID times. And, you know, I'll give you some examples. You know, when we went to sort of South Korea, for instance, we went straight from the airport, met by people in hazmat suits, taken to a quarantine hotel, tested, and then you stay there until your test results come back. You know, whereas in Japan, again, straight into effectively sort of quarantine environment. And you know, everyone around the world has obviously taken very strong measures to make sure that they avoid the spread of COVID. But it did add to the added difficulty of you know, traveling, but also actually organizing this conference. I mean, we delayed this by a year because of COVID. That was completely understandable. But climate change didn't take time off during that year. And I was absolutely determined that we have this in physical form this year. And frankly, we wanted to make sure, and this is what we were being told by these climate vulnerable countries, they wanted to sit at the same table face to face with the big economies and the big emitters. And we put in place a daily testing regime, people wearing masks at the venue, making sure that we highly encouraged vaccinations. And actually the incidence of COVID positive cases during that 2 week period with the delegates was, I think, something like sort of 2 in 1,000, compared to the Scottish population of between 11 and 12 per 1,000. So, you know, we really made it safe. And not only that, but we wanted to make sure that anyone who was coming, any delegate who was coming, was able to get vaccinated if they couldn't do it through their own sort of vaccine regime at home. So the Prime Minister put out this offer some months ago, and we helped delegates in over 70 countries get vaccinated as well. We made a big effort, and actually people really appreciated that.
So there you are then. You get to Glasgow. It's all set up. Thousands and thousands of people are there. A lot of pressure on you to bring it all together. How did you go about doing that? I know you met Barack Obama, and I remember reading his memoirs, and he talks about exactly this sort of thing where it comes down to the crunch moment in the last hours of the thing. And it, I can't remember which, was it Copenhagen, where he ambushed a meeting of the, where the Chinese were sort of carving out something, and he found out where they were and he sort of ambushed them. Did he give you any advice on what to do in the final hours of the summit?
Well, I had a chat with him actually more about what we might do in our presidency. And the one bit of advice at the end he said is that when this is all over, go and have a long holiday with your wife. I haven't yet taken up that piece of advice, but that may come. But actually, for me, those 2 weeks, that sprint at the end, of course, it was vital. And then, you know, as you said, really dramatic last few hours. But actually, the reason we were able to get this deal over the line is because we had spent 2 years, and I'd spent this last year traveling, making those relationships, building the trust, so that when you got to the crunch point and you said to countries around the world, guys, this is, you know, a deal, you're not going to be happy with all of it, no one's going to be happy with everything, but this really does move things forward in terms of more money for developing countries, more plans to cut emissions, more support to help you to adapt to a changing climate. That's what delivered this result in the end, having built that trust over 2 years. And, you know, we talk a lot, as politicians, we talk a lot about global Britain. Well, I'll tell you one thing, Matt, this was global Britain in action, right? This is the UK having built this trust amongst almost 200 countries, which allowed us to deliver this climate pact in Glasgow.
All that time, 2 years of planning, all that travelling, all that talking, and all 2 weeks of talks then in Glasgow, and it all comes down to, it seemed at least, to one word, the phase down or phase out of unabated coal power. Is that a fair characterisation of exactly what happened? Or is that just because actually it's such an enormous thing, there was so much going on? Did it really just come down to that one word?
I think that the first thing to say is that, I mean, this was, you know, I've described this as playing a little bit like playing Jenga, right? So what we were doing is building a tower of commitments from countries around the world. And there's a lot of commitments that countries have made, including coming back at the end of 2022 on their 2030 emission reduction targets. And then all it needs is one country to pull one piece of this thing out and everything collapses. I mean, it literally is like playing Jenga. And what was running through my mind in those final hours was that, you know, we couldn't really lose 2 years off work. And so in the end, as you saw, you know, China and India raises this issue around coal, around fossil fuel subsidies. But I think the first thing to say is that for the first time ever in any of these COP decisions, did we get this agreement on coal, on phasing down coal? First time ever. I mean, this is absolutely historic. And I do think it sort of spells the death knell for domestic coal around the world. You know, from my perspective, it was ensuring that we obviously, you know, worked on this language. But then, as you will have seen, if you were watching this thing sort of unfold, I was very keen to make sure that the other negotiating groups, the leaders of the other negotiating groups, were able to see what this language was before we had the formal process of whether or not this should be adopted. So it was, again, about building that sort of consensus. And it was because we'd built the trust over 2 years that we were able to get this over the line.
It was you got a bit emotional at the very end of it all.
I'm deeply sorry. I also understand the deep disappointment. But I think, as you have noted, it's also vital that we protect this package.
Thank you. What was going through your mind when that moment happened? I mean, so much pressure. Presumably, not a huge amount of sleep either.
No, not a...
Take me back to that moment.
Yeah. I mean, certainly not a great deal of sleep. I mean, I normally don't sleep more than about sort of 5 hours a night. But on this occasion, I mean, if you imagine you are in a hotel room for a few hours trying to get some kip, you go out. Basically, you don't really get to see sort of daylight. You're moving into an office which has no windows. And it was that, you know, for almost 3 weeks. And in those final 3 days, I think I must have got about 6 hours of sleep in total. So obviously, you know, I was quite tired. And for whatever reason, during that day itself, I don't think I'd eaten anything at all. So I was sustaining myself with Lucozade tablets. If you look very carefully, I was sort of surreptitiously putting Lucozade tablets into my mouth. But you know, I was, of course, it was emotional. It was emotional for a number of reasons. One is that we were getting something historic over the line. But my disappointment, because a number of people picked up on this, that I was disappointed. I wasn't disappointed with the outcome. I mean, this is a historic outcome on any count. What I was disappointed by was that after 2 years of being very open and very transparent in the way we ran this process, people felt that the final hours had been a little bit opaque. And I understand that. And you saw that being expressed by countries on the floor, people talking about their deep disappointment. And that's what I apologized for. But as I said, I mean, I think overall what we got over the line is something that actually all countries should be very happy with. Of course, they now need to deliver on the commitments.
Did you feel a bit ambushed at the very end? The waiting? No, because obviously China knows that you want to get a deal, so wait until the very last end and then pick up on this issue of phase down or fade out. Or did you know it was coming?
I think with these multilateral negotiations, there is always some drama that takes place on the final day. I mean, one of the things that I did do, I mean, this was my very first COP, by the way, so it's quite an interesting thing to be COP president on your very first COP. But one thing I did do was to talk to previous COP presidents about what had happened during their time, how those final negotiations had been. You know, I'm quite a sort of detail-focused person, so I did quite a lot of analysis on that, talking to people. So I think there was an expectation that something like this would happen. You can never be sure precisely how it'll work out. But the one point on coal, as I said, it's the first time this is in these texts. But I was also absolutely determined when we were having this discussion with the Chinese and the Indians that the language on coal, the word coal, had to stay in this text, and we managed to do that.
So what happens now, Alok Sharma? You've I assume had a bit more sleep than 6 hours in 3 days that you managed in Glasgow. Not, you know, and maybe even a meal that was not a Lucozade tablet. But what happens next? What's your job now?
So yes, I've had a little bit more sleep, and hopefully I'll get a bit more over Christmas. But the job now is that our presidency year actually started on the 31st of October, and we have a year to run up until next November when Egypt take on the COP27 presidency. You know, what we're going to do is have what I would describe, and the Prime Minister, I think, is very supportive of this, is a full-fat presidency year. And that means that we are going to be working with countries around the world, ensuring that the commitments that they have made are delivered on, the commitments to cut emissions, to look again at their 2030 emission reduction targets, to make sure more finance is available for developing countries, to make sure that actually the private sector, which is really focused on climate action now, actually comes forward, and we can get some private financing as well to help countries around the world make that transition to clean energy, for instance. All of this we will be doing, but obviously we'll do that together with our friends in Egypt and the UN.
Which countries have you particularly got your eye on just to make sure they really do stick by their commitments?
All countries have made these commitments, so they have to deliver. I was saying to you earlier, Matt, that I've talked at the COP and before the COP as being the sort of shepherd in chief. That role of shepherd in chief continues, but I will be morphing also more into auditor in chief, because that's what we need to do. We need to make sure that the commitments that have been made are delivered on. And, you know, one of the things that we did manage to do was to reach agreement on the outstanding rules of the Paris Agreement. And one of those key elements after 6 years that we managed to get over the line was an agreement on transparency. So that means now we have a common way that countries will report on in terms of the emissions that they're cutting across different sectors. And so we will be able to see when countries make a commitment, whether or not they're actually delivering on those commitments. And that is really, really important. And it provides a real underpinning for what we would try to achieve.
How confident are you that everything that was agreed in Glasgow will stick, and the knock-on effect then on keeping temperature rises to 1.5 degrees? What's the chances of that slipping and therefore the catastrophic impact of climate change as a result?
We can't afford for it to slip. I mean, you know, going into this COP, I think there was a lot of scepticism that we will be able to do as much as we have managed. But, you know, we pressed forward, and I want to pay tribute actually to all the civil servants who did a brilliant job, not just in delivering a really safe COP, but also all our negotiators, you know, the folks in the Foreign Office across different government departments who work really closely together to ensure that we got these commitments. And commitments actually not just from countries, but also from companies. So the corporate sector has really come forward in terms of recognizing that, you know, net zero is actually a big growth opportunity for them. So I don't think we can, the world really can't afford for countries not to deliver on their commitments. But the key thing now is that we have some of the mechanisms in place to hold countries to account. And if things move really pretty fast, you know, if we'd been having this discussion, Matt, this time last year, and I said to you, do you know what? We're going to have, during the next year, we're going to have all the big economies that finance coal projects internationally saying they will stop doing it from the end of 2021. If I said to you that we would have countries saying that, you know, they would phase down unabated coal, then, you know, you would have been skeptical. But we managed to do that. And I think the other thing that's worth saying is that look at how far we have actually come over the last few years. Before Paris in 2015, scientists were telling us that the world was heading towards 6 degrees of global warming by the end of this century. After Paris, because of the commitments that were made, they said we are heading to below 4 degrees. And now, with the commitments that we've got from Glasgow, we've got reports, independent reports, saying that we're heading to below 2 degrees. Now, we need those commitments to be delivered upon. And as I said in Glasgow, we've kept 1.5 alive, but the pulse is weak. And the only way you strengthen that pulse is for everyone collectively to deliver on the commitments that they've made.
And what about our own lives? What should we be doing? There's obviously lots of discussion beforehand about what we as individuals need to be doing and the role of government in that. I know, one, you know, again, on fossil fuels, one of the Climate Change Committee suggested that gas for home heating should be taxed at 20%, not the current discount of 5%. That would help to shift people away from gas. Is that the sort of thing that Britain should be looking to do, essentially ending that sort of, essentially, a fuel subsidy through government?
Yeah, so, I mean, we actually set out a net zero strategy some weeks ago, and actually was praised by the Committee on Climate Change, who said it was sort of, you know, world leading, and it was effectively an exemplar that that other countries could look to follow. So, you know, we have set out a strategy in terms of how we get to net zero, and different countries start from different starting points, right? So they will have different paths in terms of how they get to net zero in their economy. But, you know, this is another area where I think we've made a lot of progress during this year, because when we first got the COP26 role about 2 years ago, less than 30% of the global economy was covered by a net zero target. We're now at 90% of the global economy covered by a net zero target. So there is a clear realization that this is a direction of travel. And as I said, I mean, if you look at the price of renewables, for instance, around the world, they've fallen sharply. The take-up of renewables is way, way higher than people were predicting, you know, 5, 10, 15 years ago. There is a real pace and momentum here. We just need to make sure we accelerate that even faster.
I need to ask you, because, well, she came on the show a couple of times, actually. Allegra Stratton was obviously the Prime Minister's COP26 spokeswoman. She came on our show. Well, the first time she came on, she admitted she had a diesel car. And by the second time she came on, she'd got rid of it as a result, I think, of some of the comments that resulted from the first interview. We saw that she resigned last week, not actually anything to do with working on COP26, but because of that leaked video. I just wondered what impact you felt she'd had in that role and how you felt when she resigned last week.
Well, look, I mean, Allegra was a great colleague. She was a very valuable member of the team. She was the Prime Minister's spokesperson on COP. She spent a lot of time talking to stakeholders, to businesses, to civil society. She talked to our sponsors. She spent a lot of time on this. And, you know, the Prime Minister very rightly paid tribute to her. And I also want to use this occasion to pay tribute to all the hard work she did. And she's a great colleague. She's a great colleague.
She was looking to buy an electric car. Have you got one yet?
No, I'm in the market right now.
Very good. Well, maybe we should go. Maybe the new year we could go and test drive some. We could do a sort of tin pot Top Gear.
Yeah, well, if you want to put forward a detailed suggestion, I'll happily look at it, Matt.
That sounds very good. That sounds very good. So looking back then on your year, I'm sure there've been lots of windowless rooms and fueled on bad coffee and so on. But there must have been some surreal moments. What's been the weirdest thing that's happened to you in the past 12 months in your role as COP president?
Yeah, I wouldn't say weird, but I mean, you know, one of the things that I've managed to do in this role actually is to meet lots of people that I would otherwise not have met. I mean, I spent time with Arnold Schwarzenegger, sort of talking to him, people like Bill Gates, Al Gore, Nancy Pelosi. And actually, I also had, and I don't think there's any other circumstances under which I would have done this, but I spoke at Central Park as part of a global event that took place there called Global Citizen Live. So I got a chance to say a sort of few words about you know, why climate change was important. I went on straight after Cyndi Lauper. a few people clapped when I spoke, just to be clear, but far more clapped for Cyndi Lauper than they did for me. But I mean, it's been a great experience in that sense, you know, to be able to meet people and you know, have this opportunity to, you know, try and make a difference as well. And the one thing I can tell you is that wherever I've gone in the world, actually, you know, we talk about meeting sort of, you know, famous people, that's one thing. But actually, I've also had an opportunity to meet lots of youth delegates, lots of civil society groups around the world. And I can tell you that people around the world are absolutely committed to ensuring that we limit global warming and we take proper action, and that they put pressure on their own governments to ensure that those governments take action so we get climate change under control. And I see your true colours shining through. I
see your true colours. That's why I love you.
You see, you don't get that anywhere else, do you? An interview with a cabinet minister that ends with Cyndi Lauper. But really good to catch up with Alex Sharma and see how his year's unfolded. But, you know, he's got a tough year ahead to try to get countries to commit to those targets, albeit ones that only hold temperature rises to just under 2%, trying to keep 1.5 alive.
That's all we've got time for on today's episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. And you can listen via the Times Radio app. Catch me Monday to Friday, 10 to 1, live on Times Radio. And if you want to come on and play the hugely popular quiz, Can You Get to Number 10? Email me your details, matt.chorley@times.radio, and we'll get you on very soon.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.